Andrea is an Anglican professor of social theory, space and culture at the Department of Sociology at the University of Trento. Andrea's research particularly focuses on topics such as space, visibility, power, and social theory. And Andrea has published quite extensively on these and many other topics, including books such as Visibility in Social Theory and Social Research, published by Palgrave in 2010. Interstices, the Aesthetics and Politics of the Tree, an edited volume that came out with Ashgate in 2013. Then most recently, and of particular importance to this conference, is a wonderful book with a complex title, namely The Ambiguous Multiplicities, Materials, Epistemic and Politics of Subcultured Social Formations, published last year by Palgrave. In this latter book, Andrea develops a very original conception of sociality or multiplicity research program that is embedded to, but also goes beyond late 19th century debates about limitation, contagion, and suggestion. The title of his talk today is The Reactive, Social Experiences and Services and Deaths.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much, Christian, for this generous introduction. And please keep my timing, because I don't want to abuse your patience and your energies, mental energies, because the day has been so full of ideas, and we probably need a good rest to digest all this stuff. So in my talk today, I'd like to pick up the subtitle of this conference, which is Rethinking the Social. And this task recommends a certain modesty, because the rethinking means that the social has been thought and thought over again in many different ways, and probably this is the art. So in many ways I was struck today that all these debates coming from the hard sciences rebound on a way again to the matter of the social. In this last presentation we have the both camps, pro and anti-Menezes theorists, saying, you know, look back at the social. So again, we found ourselves in our kind of situation in which this social something, because it's also very interesting to look at what is attached, what is the noun that is attached to this adjective, social, is this social machinery, as we've seen in the last slide, is a social system, is a social structure, are today kind of up for grabs, because the narrative categories that we have from the 20th century don't seem to work any longer, or don't work that well any longer. That's why we are here today. So, Paracarax Autonomisma, this is the ancient recommendation from a Cynic philosopher. Which is a very strange phrase, which might mean very different things according to translation, but could mean deface the currency or revalue your currency. And it's a phrase that's associated to Diogenes, the philosopher, the Cynic philosopher, from Diogenes, from Sino, Asia Minor. It's a task in a way, the subject. The currency is very interesting in this context, because actually the Diogenes was the son of a banker who went bankrupt, and he was also involved in a strange, probably illegal money printing business stuff, and so Diogenes was expelled from his own town and he went to Athens, where he became famous for doing very challenging and very disturbing actions, such as masturbating on the public square, all these very infamous actions that were in a way kind of deliberate seeking of dishonor. So seeking dishonor was really what Cynics, philosophers were after. And in a way, I could say that this is very much interweaved with the adventure of the subject, because in a way the Cynics were one of, not only the only one, but certainly one of the first sources in this adventure of becoming a subject. So deface the currency, deface money or revalue your money, which is, of course, a very, you know, kind of assertive, even humanistic attempt of placing the I at the center. So the cynics, through this harsh treatment, they were asserting this strange creature, which must have looked very strange at the beginning, which is the subject. And when we ask, well, who are all these people who say I, who say ego, I am of themselves? This is a question that we might be, perhaps we might find so unfamiliar in a way with, because of our taking so much for granted the I. But the other part of this, so there is this money, which is in a way the adventure of value. The other part of it is parakaraxin, which is a very strange verb, which is related to karatein, which is means printing, and we printing money, and it's the verb from which also the noun character comes from. So the idea that we are peculiar in the fact that we are characters and we have character formations is again related to this strange activity of consciousness of the I as a subconscious creature. So there are, in a way, these two versions to these two entry points to social life. Let me pick my noun for the time being. I call it social life, which is very, kind of reassuring entity, because we also work as a social life at the end of the day. After a day of social structure and social cooperation, we go out for a beer and we have some social life. But the nature of this social life is, very much uncertain. And particularly, there is this idea that whereas in the 19th century, in a way, this dominant paradigm was pretty much organic one. So sociology was born under these ages of asserting this organic nature. You remember Durkheim's controversy, in a way, against not against Tarr, but against Comte in the previous generation, where the social machinery was the pitch, was the society as a machine, and you can answer to that, no, society as an organism, as an organic thing. And 20th century probably took up a different picture, which is in a certain way mirrored in this idea of structures and systems and stuff, which is probably, I would say, not the organ, but the organism, but the organization. So, the organizational life, institutional life. So, probably today these two metaphors do not work so well. So, what is the nature of social life? Is it organic? As we're trying to see again, we know that a lot of people in the hard sciences are working on this organic track, or is it organizational? And probably my idea is that it's neither the one nor the other. But let's go back to this moment, which is reaction. But after all, it's a moment, it's not, probably not even a concept, not even a theory. It's a moment where we know something might or might not happen. And it's interesting because it's a precarious moment, it's ambiguous. And I would like to install in a way my point of entry on this moment of uncertainty. Do we react? Do we not react? Because after all, mimesis is a way of reacting, but we also not react, and so we try to keep ourselves. If the subject, in a way, is a kind of conquest and it's a whole story inside social life, it's probably not the only one. So the fascinating thing about all these discussions in late 19th century is that, in a way, they found a kind of current which addresses a number of impersonal phenomena. Impersonal phenomena, and probably also pre-individual phenomena. But anyway, this moment in which we either react or not react is a kind of boundary moment, a kind of boundary state. And this individual, this unknown creature, which we know as the individual, is probably also a kind of way of managing these boundaries, an attempt at keeping these boundaries alive, at negotiating these boundaries. So, in a very naive, if you want, ontology, we could distinguish two kind of entities, objects and environments. And the object is something that stands before us. We can become subjects by having an object before us. And environments are something that, entities that surround us, they are around us. Environments or media is the idea that there is something in the middle. Environment is the idea that you can have both, you know, we have two hands, and the left and the right. That is why we argue and quarrel so ferociously about being right. So we go into opposite directions. So the environment has this peculiar quality, this peculiar nature of being invisible. So in order to see something, we need objects, and that, after all, is the lessons of Kirchhoff theory. Very easily said, easily recalled. Conversely, the individual is a creature that fears not the environment, but I would say environmentalization. The individual fears becoming environment, because becoming environment means becoming invisible, means dissolving into thin air. That's a beautiful, quip from a movie from the 1930s. Arletty, French actress from the 30s. Est-ce que j'aime l'atmosphère? And they said, do I look like I have a face like atmosphere? And of course, she is talking to a lover who, you know, like he's trying to play the romantic guy. Atmosphere that exists between two lovers, and she is a very matter-of-factly woman, and she's a little bit like an atmosphere, meaning that, you know, but certainly the individual has this problem of keeping itself as a kind of entity. And of course the liberal individualist tradition in social sciences has been premised on the individual as a kind of building block of the social. So, kind of entity that enables us to form society.
Something that
proceeds into other dimensions, which we might provisionally call the infra and the inter. This idea, which is gives a completely different view of social life, in the sense that many of the phenomena that we're trying to tackle today concerning imitation and other processes, other events that occur among us, span this anthropological range into other things, less known, crepuscular, molecular, pluviscular things. Mm-hmm. We are less equipped to deal with this, or we were essentially less equipped to deal with these fringes of social life, with these fringes. So, in a way, there is a very interesting definition of the individual by Georges Camilleri, philosopher from the 1940s, one of Foucault's mentors, who defines the individual as a kind of minimal being. And actually, traces back to the origin of the word, and the individual is something that cannot be split, something that resists falling apart, cannot be divided, or maybe cannot be divided without changing nature. So that is probably something that has to do with these regions of the social life and the work on boundaries, which is required to keep this entity alive. There's another French philosopher in the 50s, Georges Simondon, who built an entire reflection on what he called individuation rather than the individual. So the process that enables the individual to stay together and to take form. He speaks precisely of prise de forme, what we might also translate as, after all, morphogenesis. What is the origin of this form? This form of the individual, and how to keep it alive. Hence, this idea that the boundaries are very problematic, and that we have fear of the boundaries as not stable enough, and of the permeability of our individual boundaries. This is in a way what theories of diffusion in a way point to. So there are again two images, one of which is diffusion and the other is probably, again we need a kind of Greek word, is archē, as a kind of principle, but also a kind of hierarchical principle. So archē, from also from which architecture comes from, is the head. Again, we go again to this idea of leadership. So there is the beginning is something that commands. So this idea that there is something willing that is transmitted. So diffusion gives a kind of headless image of society, where there is no beginning and no end, where things just circulate, or not, maybe they stop circulating, but there is no real starting point. Arche, on the contrary, gives an idea that, and this is again, we find these two images in every theory. When we look at theories of power, of course there is this idea that power is, as Max Weber would have it, the transfer of will from one who commands to one who obeys. Or, we have probably more contemporary theories of power that see how power gives shape to certain formations and stuff. But certainly, again, we have these two vision of social life, and the work on boundaries is crucially located on that. Why my title is the individual as a creature of surfaces and depths. Well, on the one one hand, these surfaces are precise and precise with these boundaries. And so here we have this idea that the individual is exposed to others. It appears to others. So there is this idea again of the visibility of the individual. There is a kind of perceptual system that relates to these appearances. It's very interesting because I recently, coming from the social sciences, I increasingly need sources that come from other sciences, and biology is a very interesting one, and there is this zoologist named Adolf Bartman who wrote beautifully about animal plumage and feathers and skin and the appearances of animals. He describes these outer appearances as the very inwardness of the animal. So the inward is not something that is deep buried at the core of the individual, like in the belly, but the inwardness is really the fact that we appear to others with certain scales and colorations, and there is this attempt by our skin at serving what Bartman calls a viewing eye. So we are viewed, and this is again a kind of surface theory of the individual, which goes in a long tradition in a way in sociology. This would be Gerald Zimmer, who would be the originator of this thing, and certainly sociologists like Henry Goffman could also be allocated to these surface theorists. So how do we appear to others? But there are also stories of deaths. So if the death of the individual is not really the belly, the social death of the individual as a social entity, not as an organic entity, is not the bones and the belly, then what is this death? And why are we so interested in these psychic deaths? Perhaps it's not the not even the unconscious, or maybe the unconscious is one of the ways in which this individual deaths have been dealt with. But there is something like, let me call it very modestly, a gap. A gap. If we take even the individual as a sheer black box, we notice that there is a gap between the input and the output. So this gap must have something to do with the individual. So if, in a way, this kind of corpuscular regions are the regions where the individual establishes itself out of, it emerges out of these much more confused entities, much more confused flows, or much more confused diffusionary processes, where in a way crowds are located, but also sects. Let's not forget sects. Sects as compact, a small cluster of extremely cohesive people with a strong commonality. There has been a tendency in crowd theories, especially in the 19th century, to focus more on crowds, because we were looking, we were thinking large because of the new society that was coming ahead, the mass society and stuff. But the history of sects is another powerful current that prolongs into contemporary, perhaps, cooperation. At least the chief executive officer collaboration, or maybe even hip hop crews, all these other sort of social formations which we are not very equipped to talk about. So if these things are the margins, where is the center? And of course there is this idea that the central sphere, the central range of continuums where we want to locate agency, this, this thing we are so proud of. But in a way, the debate on effects and uneasiness and stuff is a kind of reminder, at least, that we should also locate not only agency, but also patience. The fact of being passive as much as active. So the place for passivity. And it's very important, and also thanks to Nidish for this insight, that the Nachmachen Nietzsche's piece about has very much to do with feeling.
Strange notion of a fragments.
Salience is in Renaissance. In Renaissance understanding is the way we immediately perceive meaningful shapes. The word of salience is the word of shape, well-defined shapes, which exist on a background. And we are capturing them not as sum of components, but as immediate entities, as immediate meaningful creatures. So there is here a kind of holistic, if you want, insight. This thing may be composed of traits and stuff, but it has this immediacy to it, attached to it. When it comes to pregnancy, there is another thing which is much more a traveling adventure. So pregnancies are sort of infusions of forces or moments of intensification which are of vital interest to the animal, Renaissance speculates. The word of salience is, in a way, is also the word of objects, and the word of pregnancy is also the word of media, if you want, the word of media. This kind of adventure meaningfully correlates to a number of counter theories of counter theorists in the 20th century, including physicians like Richard Semon, or literary authors like Georges Bataille and other Benjamin, and also, I would say, Elias Canetti. Particularly interesting is that all these authors have notions in their thinking that remind us of this act of inscribing, except that in inscription, actually, Semon came up with this idea, with this term in the early 20th century, called engrams. So there is the idea that something is written in, so that we are engrammated, engrams, if you want, we are written with certain things. These marks perhaps are not writings in any conventional sense, but they recall this activity of impressing something. And it's very interesting that in the late 19th century so much attention was paid, for instance, to scars and tattoos. Scars and tattoos are something that is precisely on the skin of the individual, yet so crucial to its enterprise. In a way, we know that memories are also inscribed in our flesh. And Canetti speaks of something very similar with this reflection on commands. We started with this idea that imparting a command to someone is completely different from suggestion and imitation and stuff. In both cases, however, there is this passage through an element which is, Canetti, in the case of command, speaks of this sting. It's kind of sting, so it's being commanded is like this sting which is inserted into our skin and remains into our skin. Once you carry out the command, this original skin remains in you. It's a completely different model from the normativity, for instance. It's nothing normative. It's not that by carrying out a command, you accept this norm into part of your behavioral scheme. The sting remains as something, and it says precisely non-human. Non-human. It's a persistence of this passage through the non-human that is interesting here in order to be individual. So just to conclude, this problems, these propagations, these diffusions, these flows that have to do with our social life. There's a very interesting verb which René Tang uses, is investir, which is very difficult to translate in English to me. It might mean, so, you know, both its economic meaning to invest into something, but most precisely also to run over something, to sink, also to get through, to penetrate, and to surround. So it says that pregnancies invest cells. It's a very strange way of putting it to explain this propagation thing and these moments in which channeling occur. The channeling of pregnancies might be perhaps described, and it's very interesting that Renaton picks up a picture from quantum theory, because he was very well acquainted with quantum theory. I'm not, but the idea is very simple. In a way, what we associate with the calls the basic state, the basic state, and if you look at the, let's say, excited state, maybe this can be applied to, you know, individual creatures, to individual animals, but also to this complex secret of sadnesses and pregnancies, is here. The excited state is paradoxically located below the threshold of the basic state. Hence, this famous, and it's the same in quantum physics, there is a particle who has a certain amount of energy, and there is an obstacle which would be impossible for that quantity of energy to overcome, yet there is still a possibility in physics to record the presence of the particle on the outside of the wall, let's say. This is known as quantum tunneling, going this way. And probably this pregnant world is located in this peak here. It's this strange thing. It's not by chance, I think, that before when we heard Durkheim, the elementary forms pages insists on this fact that in the religious assembly, in the ritual, in collective rituals and stuff, the individual is brought, you know, beyond, is brought above his forces, is brought beyond itself, in a kind of strange region, which Durkheim, you know, boldly asserted it's the sacred, is society as a kind of accomplished way. But unfortunately, Durkheim subscribed very much to this idea. This beyond the individual might have to do with these pregnancies, which act as, in ethology, they would be called super releasers in a way. They kind of trigger. So, if actually this triggering moment is something that occurs to bring, you know, this adventure along, perhaps this movement could be interesting to try to specify. It's the beginning of something. I'm not quite sure what, but this idea that we are going to do an adventure, which is shaped as a powerful, and probably all the phenomena that we are dealing with when we talk about imitation, contagion, diffusion, motion. Emotion actually comes from motion, and this movement thing, this moment of movement, this moment of living, which has a lot to do with the activity, for instance, of leading. When we're talking about leaders, you know, this leading thing is, you know, as if there is something which can bring the salience at this point, that we don't need any longer the individual, but the salience beyond itself, above itself. That is why I, in my little book, I propose this kind of layering of the individual. So once we have this individual, we can also have strange interlocked circuits of the individual. And of course, the first basic one would be this stimulation and reaction circuit, a kind of physical chemical layer. Where, of course, the semiosis does not occur, so there's no trick, there's no deceit. But this layer is interlocked with a different, completely different layer, which is the action perception layer. So when we come to this skin of the individual, we have this distance necessarily, this perception circuit is related to this gap between the individual and the environment. At this level, of course, semiosis is crucial. At this level, the whole semiotic thing occurs. And probably there are more layers, and certainly another layer would be what might be called this passions expression layer, passive expressive layer, as a kind of third layer. Probably these are also modes of existence in way of describing it. But these three ways, probably there are many modes. But again, this would be an attempt, and let me conclude like this, to kind of reward this notion of the individual through a number of processes, through a number of circuits, which might help us to, take on board a number of important insights that we have from this theory without necessarily turning this theory into cradles that we have to subscribe to or, stick to for a matter of honor. So also try to seek this honor, as the saying is. So, thank you very much.
Questions? Yes,
yeah. I didn't really, could you repeat the one with the infra-inter thing?
Yes. What I said is a very, basic way of trying to overcome this vision of society as composed of individuals which are closed. And of course we have also a tradition of criticism against this image. Just read, for instance, Norbert Elias, he criticizes this idea of what he calls homo clausus. So there is all this relational approach in social science that we are familiar with. But by moving this vertical axis into an horizontal axis, it seems to me that it becomes easier to see, to have an insight into the fact that probably the infra. So we usually study under the rubric of psychology, and the inter are sort of the same nature. Mm-hmm. This kind of, if you want, naturalist vision.
Right. Myself, I'm a listener. Thanks a lot for this talk. My question concerns some of the categories that you make use of here. So, the notion of reaction, for instance, which is of course important here, seems to be, for me, a kind of mimetic notion. So reaction relates to something, either affirmatively or negatively. So, but it's inherently mimetic somehow. Whereas the language of boundaries would seem to operate in a rather different repertoire or register somehow, that the whole notion of contagion contagion theory would try to problematize a strict notion of markers, right? That self dissolves basically due to these processes. So what are the relations?
actually in this tradition of the, let's say, irregular authors, like for instance, Bataille, she knows very well this page where Bataille says that human beings are kept together only by the blessure, by the wounds. So where the boundary fails in a way, then you can have some opening to the other and some sort of commonality. And okay, it was prolonged, this Durkheimian idea that that you are constitutively open to this other horizon, let's say. Still, I think the openness and closure work together, and this probably is the merit of a theory like Luhmann in a way. And it's not by chance. I think that Luhmann traces from biological theories where you have both a kind of in biological when you speak about organisms, particularly, you have both thermodynamic openness, so you're constantly permeable, the boundary is constantly permeable, and you must have an organizational closure in order to, you know, protract your existence. So this is anti-Spinozist in a way, because Spinoza would say that beings want to persist, just persist by default, they persist. And this life is a completely different is a completely different story. You don't persist by just by inertia. You need a lot of work to persist. And probably the boundaries, probably boundary is a kind of misleading image, especially in English. But this idea that there is a porosity of boundaries might help, and this idea that there is a twin work on boundaries of both openness and closure.
I was interested in your type on this idea of surfaces and depth. Yeah. It sort of disappeared in a way.
Yeah.
And it sort of reappeared in an interesting allusion, maybe say to the trauma of the wound, right? The idea of the tattoo of the scar. Because there is, going back to the late 19th century, a deep suspicion of the surface, right? At the same time that the surface becomes a sort of an in-depth reading. Hidden things, like criminality, what have you. And then an attempt to sort of bring to the surface hidden things, like infectious disease, so this idea of history of the death, which is a great book, is that something to do with your idea of the surface and the death? An idea, in other words, the idea of a certain social, a certain concept. Suspicion of the surface.
Yeah.
Was that a completely different surface depth dynamic?
Yeah, but in my proposal, I would say that the surfaces are the register of the semiotics, so the place where you can also lie, in a way, the place where you put up your appearances, but which are also very cogent in a way, because you exist in a way that the attention of being existing in public is this attention here. You are subjected to this being seen. And because we have been talking so much about the actor and the theater in Yiddish, I think this is a place where also the theatrical experience exists in a way. And whenever we go to a gig or to a concert, to a theater, beside this pathos story, there is certainly the fact that we are kind of feeling the relief in watching, also watching unashamedly, in a way.
That's not what we're about. If you get back to the idea of power and skin color, of racial theories and criminality, right? That's a very different idea about how the surface is acting.
the surface is also the graspable element of the individual, in a way. So all attempts at governing individuals in a way pass through this place, in a way. And it's a place, you know, it's a battlefield in a way, the surface. Very current, since it's been very current since the surgery for many years, something because it captures this idea that the group exists by allowing inner circulations and establishing this boundary around it. So, but at the same time, it exists as an as a creature that works on the in-out thing, and it's also very much connected to Lévi-Strauss when he speaks about this ethnocentrism, so the idea that we are better than other groups, and that by that is sort of this establishment of a subjectivity is always this establishment of a boundary, also axiological, so ingrained with a notion of value or worth. Again, this by allowing this inner circulation, what happens is that this creature, the group, is an environment actually. It's already environmental. And so, it's a very strange story because the experience of crowds, even in literary descriptions, since the late 19th century, but not necessarily only then, is the experience that the city, the urban environment, is turned into the human element is turned into an environment. It's not a summation, a sum of individuals. It's completely environmental. And so what does it mean that a group, which is supposed to be an object, an entity, is actually the environment? So it's a very interesting movement in Gestalt terms also.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it's all very inspiring and original. Let's talk about insight. I couldn't help thinking about that. So
it's kind of a famous picture in the history of phenomenology. The clench fist and the angry fist. You find it in Schultz and in Schiele and so speaks about it. And he uses up to the million and what he says is like this is an angry fist, and then later on he writes, there's no psychological fact behind them. And the question is about what that actually means. And I've always thought, because he addresses Husserl and it's a critique, and in Husserl, of course, it's a sign. It's a sign of something that goes on at the interior, the mental life of the individual. But by Monti, he says this, there's no psychological behind it. Could one address that as a layer in your body, where the communication between bodies takes place at a level, so to speak, where bodies have not yet insides and outsides? You understand what I mean? I mean, there's no attribution of a psychological life to you. You don't mean something, it's just an anchor fist at the very forefront of intuition. Right, and of course, without thinking about it. But there is this layer in the experience where there is no connection, where bodies, in a certain sense, are closer to other bodies without insides and outsides than to your own consciousness, in that sense. You understand what I mean? Maybe, does that belong that there will someplace there in your.
Yeah, it would probably be higher towards the third layer because it has so much to do with this. Expressive dimension, which is the life of these not intentions but with the T, but intentions with the S. So this moments where René Thom is very clear when to define a pregnancy is very difficult, but it's very clear the example that he says when he takes the Pavlov's dog. He says basically, if you take the Pavlov's dog, it's very clear that food is a kind of pregnant element for fragments. And the ring valve thing, it's a kind of sub fragments. So you can have this, you know, energy movement. So the fragments has been moved to a completely different kind of element or item. Because, you know, without in a way changing nature, that's the mystery of fragments, that they pass through completely different elements, retaining their, you know, the meaning. And then he says that this thing works in steps, like by moving fragments lose their energy, so the ring bell is kind of weakened fragments vis-a-vis the food, which is still retains, you know, with its beautiful smell, it retains this stronger thing. But the interesting lesson is that how you move through this element, which is of a completely different nature, it's a sense that's completely constituted through a different thing. So this perhaps might, let's say, something about this boundary work, because this boundary work is not, you know, the boundary is, it's very easy to imagine this boundary as our skin. That we know that the boundary is not the skin. For instance, in Simmel, we have this elaboration on the sphere, the invisible bubble that surrounds us, the bubble of Fonberg says. And we know that we are always full of processes which we treat as our, you know, part of our individuality. So the individual is not necessarily a pure creature. It's a protracted work on this boundary negotiation in a way. In what can be. So the inside. Bartman and Zimmel and Goffman would concur that the deepest thing is the appearance. So that there is no depth. And they would say that they are surface theorists, because they say anything meaningful happens at the surface. Meaning is a surface trick or a surface phenomenon, which can only happen. Because there is a discontinuity between two things, so everything is located on the horizon. I also want to come from this other strange death experience, which however is not, you know, the inside of our organism. Again, because I'm taking the individual not as an organic entity, but as a little piece of social life. This thing which is social life, and so the inside is not really our, you know, it's not our lungs and our belly, but the inside is you know, again, an experience in intensity. So maybe it's not that clear, but again, it's a matter of how we imagine these relations, you know, these constitutive relations.
I'm not going to take up more time, just that's something that confuses me, that sometimes you look kind of internally, right, in a philological perspective, and then suddenly you can kind of go substantiate.
Absolutely, because if there were just a recipe to keep together, because I come in a way also from phenomenology, but I also increasingly interested in these authors from the natural sciences, and so with an ecological, if you want, tradition. So just the rare way to have something that, you know, brings together this phenomenological insight and these ecological insights. Because after all, actor-natural theory, what they did is just, you know, keep the ecological view and just discard the phenomenological one. And so they criticized so much, for instance, approach and stuff, no? In Latour's book on Paris, Bilanzi, they criticized a lot this idea of open-ended systems that are closed, so they are synchronous. But still, this, I want to give both, you know, insights from ecology and insights from phenomenology. And I don't know precisely where they can meet. So it's
really positive.
Yeah.
I don't think there are any more questions, so thanks a lot.
Sorry.